supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will discuss how exactly to harvest the garlic I hope you all planted last fall, and how to get it to last for a full year. That's the tricky part. We're also going to talk to the author of a new book that describes our planet as a rambunctious garden. It's a new way to look at invasive plants. That's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Amy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Amy. Where are you?
I am in Brady, Texas.
Brady, Texas. Now, where is that?
It's actually in the geographic center state.
Okay, so you're in the middle of Texas.
That's right, on the very edge of what's kind of called the Hill Country.
Okay. All right, very good. What can we do for Amy, dead center in the Lone Star State?
Well, I have a question about pomegranates. We have several pomegranate trees in our yard at the house. And this year, they've just kind of gone crazy, and they're making fruit like nobody's business. And I'd like to harvest some of the fruit, but I would prefer to do it before the bugs and the birds really get started on it. So I was wondering, if I pick the fruit early, will it continue to ripen after I take it off the tree, or do I have to leave it on the tree?
The answer is not the one you were hoping for. I'm going to recommend a book for you as well. My friend Lee Reich has written many books on growing fruit, but I was just reading over his book, Grow Fruit Naturally, recently, and I lingered on pomegranates because they're so weird. I mean, I can't think of another fruit that you grow just so you can suck on the seeds.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some seed sucking and seed spitting with watermelons, but pomegranates put it all to shame.
They are a lot of work.
Yes, and he says there's no way to eat them politely, which is one of the things I think Lee likes about them, is you must revert to the savage if you're going to really enjoy a pomegranate out in the field, you know. But unfortunately, he was very specific in that the fruits have to be allowed to ripen on the tree, that they will not ripen. They stop as soon as they're picked. So they're unlike some things. Peaches will continue to ripen up a little bit. Tomatoes, of course, will ripen up. Pumpkins ripen up wonderfully once they're full size. But pomegranates are one of those things that must ripen on the tree. And If you wait too long, they start to split open.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is going to increase any kind of pest pressure, attract ants, attract birds. So I believe, and you'll need to do a little bit of research on this yourself, but one of the first things that Lee said to judge ripeness is timing. Beginning about 5 months after the baby fruits appear, that's when your pomegranates are going to start turning ripe.
Oh, wow, a long time. Okay.
Yeah. So the timing is the first part. Not so much the color of the skin, but the texture of the skin is going to change. It's going to, I believe, take on a kind of a metallic look. And very much like watermelons, you can now tap the fruit, and it'll have a different sound than an unripe fruit.
Ah.
But you want first, and obviously, if you're waiting, you're waiting, you're waiting, and you start to see fruit splitting open, that means they're ripe. That means you're going to have a pomegranate party. You're going to have pom teenies until they come out your ears. But it is right before they start to split open that they are at their absolute peak of ripeness. Now, do you have insects attacking the fruits before they become ripe?
No, not really. But I noticed that once they appeared to be pretty darn close to becoming ripe, the birds move in and the bugs move in.
Well, you know, maybe they're secret agents. Maybe you watch them instead of doing all this crazy stuff. You know, honey, I just saw a bird go for one of your pomegranates. Okay, get the baskets. We're picking.
Okay, that's what I will definitely do. I sure do appreciate the information. Thank you so much.
All right, and don't forget to double check me on that, but those are the basics. You enjoy them.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Hey, Mike, I had some field dirt delivered here because a concrete truck had made a lot of ridges in my ground, you know, to put in the footers. And I was wondering, can I grow grass on that field dirt? It's like lighter than the regular topsoil. Or should I mix it with black leaf compost or grass seed, you think?
Where are we?
Rehoboth Beach, Delaware.
Oh, what a beautiful area. You know, John, the Delaware beaches are like the undiscovered treasures of the East Coast. I've done a lot of work in Bethany Beach and Rehoboth, and it's just such a beautiful part of the shoreline down there.
Oh, it's gorgeous, especially now.
But nobody talks about it the way they talk about, like, Ocean City, Maryland, or Wildwood, or, you know, things like that. You got this kind of hidden treasure.
Yeah, it's terrific.
So you had some work done around your house, and
you know what happened? You know, the big, huge concrete trucks, they were pouring footers, so mm-hmm. the truck backed right on my property to do the footers, and it was a heavy concrete truck. It made these deep ridges, like grooves in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a guy come and dump some of this field dirt, like, on top. It's a lighter brown, and I'm wondering, should I mix, like, some black leaf compost?
I wouldn't. When was the field dirt dumped off?
About 3 weeks ago.
Okay. You know nothing about it. You got it for free?
I paid $100 for a truckload, but okay. It's...
But you didn't try to get topsoil or compost or anything?
No, I should have, right?
Yeah. We just did a question of the week about Bishop's weed, which is a plant that bedevils many people. And one of the things I was kind of stunned by as I was researching the plant was that it often shows up in fill dirt. So what I would do for now, because we're also about to hit the height of summertime, is I would level that area, you
okay.
know, and I would keep watering it. We want to see what comes up.
Oh, okay.
Because there may be contaminants in it. There may be bad seed. There may be weed seeds in there. And then these ruts and everything and the spot where you got the fill dirt dropped, surrounding that is a regular lawn, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Do you know what kind of lawn it is?
Oh, Mike, I'm sorry, I don't know.
That's okay. I can ask you a couple of questions. Does it stay green over the winter?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so it's a cool season lawn. Does it ever spread to fill in its own bare spots?
Yes, it does.
Oh, okay. So you probably have a combination of bluegrass and rye, or perhaps you may have a complete bluegrass lawn. And the lawn is in all sides of this area, correct?
Yes, it surrounds the house. You're right.
Okay, you're not going to have to sow anything.
Oh, really?
No. Yeah. I think what we want to do is we do want to create a stale seed bed, though.
Okay.
So what I want you to, and it are these ruts now level?
Yeah, they're level. I leveled them out. But it's that fill dirt. It's like a tannish color. It's not as dark as the topsoil.
Well, that was your mistake, not mine.
Yeah, you're right. It was.
But yeah. It is the right height.
Oh, yes, the right height, Mike.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is I want you to water that.
Okay.
And I want you to, do you have a nice hoe with a good sharp head on it?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. I want you to water that, and I want you to really keep an eye on it. And if we start to see plant growth from that area, I want you to hoe it out while the plants are young.
Okay.
This is called creating a stale seed bed. You deliberately level an area with suspect soil, and you water it, and then, without disturbing the soil as much as you can, just slice their little heads off at the soil line.
Okay.
And then, once we get to the fall, you have two choices. By the time we get to late August, you know, your grass doesn't like summer. Cool season grasses don't like summer, especially the kind of intense heat they often get down the shore.
Yes.
So you're not going to do anything until the end of August. By the end of August, when the nights start getting longer and cooler, you should see your grass moving over into this area.
Okay.
At that point, when we know for sure we've controlled any bad weeds, then you are more than welcome to get a small load of compost, but you're not going to mix it. You would put the compost right on the surface of this tan dirt.
Okay.
Don't mix it. That would just bring more weed seeds up.
Okay.
And then if you truly have grass that fills in its own bare spots, I would let nature take its course, because by the time we get to the holidays, that area will be completely covered again.
Okay, beautiful, Mike. That sounds great.
My pleasure, John. You have fun, and you invite me down to swim in your ocean.
Okay, Mike. Take care.
All right, man.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn gardeners to be on the lookout for late blight on their blessed tomatoes. This disease has become a real problem in recent years and tends to be worst when the weather is cool and wet. There's no cure. The only thing you can do is destroy affected plants quickly to protect other gardens. But don't go looking for the signs and symptoms under T for tomatoes in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with this rambunctious garden we live on, how to harvest and store your garlic, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, garlic harvest time is almost here. It might be here for some of you. You got to go out and check. We'll tell you how to do that. And then we'll tell you how to store it. We'll also have more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it is time to welcome today's guest, Emma Maris, author of Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. It came out in 2011 from Bloomsbury. Emma came into our studios when she was a keynote speaker at Earth Perfect, Nature, Utopia, and the Garden, a symposium put on by the University of Delaware. Emma, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Well, thank you for coming in today, and thank you for being one of the people who I believe is trying to take a sane look at the issue of invasive plants. We're an organic gardening show, and I have a hard time when people go into the woods with big tanks of herbicides killing plants and then want environmental medals for their good work. What happened? How did we get here with this list of good plants and bad plants?
Well, I think there's a long history there, but maybe the short answer is that at some point early on in the discussion of where plants belong, a slightly militaristic rhetoric started to creep in. We started talking about invaders rather than, you know, just non-natives.
Aliens.
Yeah, aliens. And then we started talking about beating them back and routing them out and going after them. And there became this very sort of hostile way of looking at it. Of course, the plant doesn't know where it's supposed to be. It's just growing.
And the people who expressed this hostility were, in the rest of their life, avowed plant lovers.
What has been troubling to me is just when plants that are not necessarily causing any harm are targeted for removal just because they're non-native. And that seems to me to be too purist.
And who's to judge what's harm and what's not harm? I've had people who work for these premier horticultural industries who do these beautiful ornamentals who've come out to my landscape to hand carry strapped into a baby's car seat this special new holly they've bred or something like that. And then they see wineberry canes all over my property. You can almost see their fingers twitching for the container of Roundup. And they go, how can you tolerate these? Are you lazy? Do you have arthritis? And I go, have you ever tasted the berries?
Right, yeah. Garlic mustard is pretty tasty as well. Another despised invader.
Easily the most despised by a core of, let's say, native plant enthusiasts, because garlic mustard apparently does secrete something into the soil that does actually attack other plants.
So I think it depends on what your goals for your site is. And if your goal for your site is that you want a certain plant to be there and garlic mustard is getting in the way of that, then I can see why you'd want to remove it. And likewise, if your goal for a particular site is that you want it to be just like the way it was in 1500 or something like that, then that's your goal. And then in that case, sure, go, let's get the hatchets out. But if your goal is something broader, like I just want things to be pure, or I want to put things back the way they used to be, I think this has become no longer a possibility in our modern world where everything is all mixed up and moved around.
We were talking before the interview started about Peter Del Tredici and his great book, Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast. And one of the things he does that I found most admirable is he has this encyclopedia of, quote, bad plants. And with every listing, it has this list of marvelous things that they do well, that they do better than any other plant. Erosion control, being able to grow in salty water, providing food and shelter for wildlife, being a pioneer plant. It's hard for someone like me to imagine that every plant doesn't have some kind of a purpose.
Well, I mean, a lot of the plants that are now hated as invasives were introduced intentionally, precisely because they had these admirable qualities that we wanted, like fast growth or erosion control.
There are so many plants in my landscape that other people consider invasive. Right now, the multiflora rose, which, you know, was planted as a living fence. Now, I beat it back and beat it back and beat it back, and it just seems to encourage it. But it's in full bloom right now. And the scent that fills the air from those little roses at nighttime is intoxicating. My wife and I were sitting out on our deck a couple of years back, and she goes, oh my God, what's that? What's that beautiful smell? And I go, that's number 3 on the FBI's least wanted list.
Queen Anne's lace by the side of the road is a very beautiful sight, and that's also considered to be an invasive.
And the flowers of Queen Anne's lace might be one of the absolute best attractors of pollinators and beneficial insects and keeping native bees alive.
Yeah, and that's a scenario that we saw play out with the salt cedar, the tamarisk plant, where that was targeted for removal until it was noticed that a lot of endangered birds were nesting in it. So then it becomes, do you steal the home from the endangered bird just so you can make sure that a plant is not where it's not supposed to be? I don't want to make it seem as if there's never a good reason for removing a non-native. I think that oftentimes there are. It's just, I think that the dictum should be to ask questions first and then shoot.
Well, and you call your book Rambunctious Garden.
Yeah.
Is that just nature, the whole planet that we live on? Is the entire planet a rambunctious garden? Because that's certainly how I see it.
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. I mean, I wanted the title to work both ways, that the book is about in part coming to terms with the massive human influence on the planet and learning to how we can move forward and still have a relationship with nature that's good and positive, and there can still be lots of diversity even if we're not going to be able to go back to pristine wilderness. So it becomes a more of a garden planet. But that doesn't mean that it has to be a really formal garden with little lined paths and knotwork and everything has to be neat and tidy. It can be rambunctious. It can be kind of half wild, half feral. It can have its own self-willed corners, even though we are so dominant on the landscape.
I'll see you and I'll raise you and say, those feral corners are going to be there, whether we want them to, whether we allow them to or not, because I think nature is stronger than us.
Yeah, and I think that the perspective of gardeners is really useful in this area because, you know, people criticize my view as saying that we are controlling the earth or we are somehow masters of the earth. But the gardening metaphor, I chose it explicitly because every gardener knows that you're not in control. I have known some of the scientists I've interviewed have had all volunteer gardens. They essentially took out their lawns and just sat on the porch and watched to see what would happen. And it's amazing the diversity that you can get. And sure, you get a lot of these guys that are on the hit list, but you also get a huge amount of diversity and beauty just by doing nothing. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, because one of the things Del Tredici says, and I believe you say in your book, Rambunctious Garden, is that native plants might not have the environment to thrive anymore. It's not the 1500s, it's not the 1600s, or whenever you think the native plant clock started, because right. there's no agreement on that. But it's a different world. It's a different population growth. It's a different yeah. temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you go back and look at the sort of pollen record, like a lot of paleoecologists do, and look at just how the sort of dominant tree species have waxed and waned and moved and mingled across North America over the last several hundred thousand years as the temperatures change and move around. I mean, things that seem to us like they were always this way and this is the timeless paradise were often only a couple hundred or a couple thousand years old. Those ecosystems were then before that different. They were split up. Different species were hanging out together. So these things are totally mutable. I think that one thing that will be really interesting to your listeners who enjoy working with native plants is starting to think about looking like one, you know, hardiness zone down and saying, what are the native plants from there that might like to come hang out in my garden as the climate changes? Can I be a refuge for these plants as things get too hot for them in their ancestral homelands? And I think this is a really interesting way that gardeners, even with tiny amounts of space, can get involved in major stuff. But scientists are a little nervous about us gardeners just doing this ad hoc and without the authorization. But you know what? Gardeners have always been moving plants around.
Didn't you even find in your research that when invasive plants moved into an area, rather than there just be one giant gorilla in the corner, that the diversity of species tends to increase?
Yes, that's right. And you know, there a lot of scientists will want me to be very careful about this. There's a lot of caveats. It's, you know, in certain places like islands and lakes, you can certainly get these kind of monocultures. And there's a concern that the sort of global diversity would decrease if invasives manage to drive things extinct, which they tend to only be able to do that on islands or lakes. But on the local level, it's generally the case that new species add to diversity rather than smothering it.
Well, we could go on for a long time, and I have to tell our listeners that we've only touched on one small section of your book, which really does cover the entire animal, vegetable, and every other living thing kingdom on the planet. Emma Maris is the author of Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. She was a keynote speaker at Earth Perfect, Nature Utopia in the Garden, which was a symposium held at the University of Delaware back in June from the 6th to the 9th. Emma, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
You're welcome.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Vern, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, Vern. How are you, man?
I'm good. It's a beautiful day out, and, you know, when the sun's shining and everything's going right.
Okay, and where is Vern?
Vern's in Akron, Ohio.
Oh, I had two visits there. The first one went really well, and the second time nobody came out to see me.
Winter or summer?
Oh, no. The first one was in January, and I had one of the biggest crowds I ever talked to. And then the second one was last year at a home show, also around, like, in the early spring. And I couldn't draw flies, man. It was like everybody.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it showed me you don't go back to a place the second time. You Ohioans catch on fast. What can we do for Vern in Akron?
Well, I've got a crab apple tree that was always been pretty healthy until just a few years ago. And now it seems like right after it blooms, the leaves start falling off. They get a little brownish, and by the end of June, it's almost bare.
Well, my friend Lee Reich, who is our small fruit growing expert, author of many books on pruning, on growing all kinds of fruit, once talked about how beautiful the crabapple tree in our driveway was when it was in full bloom. And it didn't look like much the rest of the year, but it was worth it for those 3 weeks. And Lee goes, it's closer to 10 days if you're lucky, and it's the ugliest tree out of season that you can possibly plant.
Well, even uglier without any leaves on it.
Well, you know, this is unfortunately sometimes the norm for these trees. That's why a lot of people eventually get rid of them. Flowering cherries look beautiful all year long. Peach trees are surprisingly ornamental four seasons, despite their pest and disease problems. But yeah, my crabapple tree looks like holy heck right now, and I kind of expect it to. But let's how many years has the tree been in the ground?
It's been in quite a while. The house was built in 75. I'm not sure.
So it's an old tree.
Afterwards, that the tree was. In the spring when it blooms, it is beautiful.
Right. And is it mulched or fed?
It has been mulched, but it hasn't been mulched for a long time.
Okay, good. And is it ever fed?
No.
Good. Established trees don't need to be fed, and mulching almost always causes problems with trees. Is it growing out of a lawn? Is it in a flower bed? What's underneath it?
It is in a flower bed surrounded by a lawn, and it's kind of like a weeper. You know, it comes out and then overlooks like an umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it back maybe every other year.
Oh, when do you prune it?
Usually in the spring, early in the spring before it gets a lot of leaves on it.
Oh, okay. Anytime from the midwinter through when it's done blooming. I mean, the perfect time to prune flowering crabapples would be after the last flowers fall.
I see.
You know, it's possible that the flower bed, and is your lawn treated? Do you have a service come and treat your lawn?
No, I have in the past, but no, I got rid of it, and it hasn't been treated. I mean, I've been putting fertilizer on it myself for probably the last 6 years.
Okay, what time of year do you fertilize your lawn?
Well, I try to follow the step program.
You need to get on a 12-step program.
12-step?
Yeah, because these 4-step programs are bad for lawns. If you feed your lawn in the summer, your lawn is going to have brown spots, bare spots, and lots of problems. You should feed your lawn naturally in the spring and in the fall. Because the tree is so close to it, the feedings you give your lawn are going to affect the tree. So you want to try to keep cheap chemical fertilizers away from there. And you want to just feed twice a year in the spring and fall and always return your clippings to the lawn. Don't bag them and take them away.
Yeah, I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I mean, there's never a good reason to take the clippings away from a lawn. And every time you do, you starve the lawn.
One other question. I have several trees that I had cut down and had the stumps ground out. I was wondering if that natural ground-up wood is okay to leave as a mulch.
No, it will it will harm any plant that it surrounds. You don't see wood mulch out in the woods, do you?
No.
Plants were never meant to grow with these giant chunks of wood, or especially small ground-up pieces of wood around them. It actually robs the nutrients from the soil. To try to help your apple tree look a little bit better, you can spread some compost around the base. Don't let those plants get out of control underneath. Don't feed them chemical fertilizers. And, you know, really just accept the fact that flowering apple trees are not four-season trees. You get those beautiful blooms, and then it is not unusual for them to be the shame of the neighborhood for the rest of the summer. So you got what you got. Flowering cherries, weeping cherries, you want to replace that, you'll have a tree that'll look good all year round. All right, good luck, man. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn you that they're going to be serving bugs, specifically cricket fritters, teriyaki glazed hissing cockroach brochettes, and silkworm summer rolls at the Morris Arboretum of the University of Pennsylvania from 6 to 8 p.m. on July 17th. In an evening of adventurous eating. Got that right. Thankfully, guests will also enjoy beers and wines, especially chosen to complement the evening's menu. But don't you go saying, what? No cicada McNuggets just yet? Because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, how to harvest and preserve your garlic. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is dedicated to providing all things needed for planting and growing gardens. Information, instructions, supplies, and more online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. A discussion on how to harvest the garlic that I hope you planted last fall, and then what to do with it to make sure you get to eat a full 12 months of your own delicious stinking rose. We'll get to that after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bethany, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Bethany. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am just fine, thank you. Where is Bethany good?
Johnson City, Tennessee.
Down in the Tri-Cities area, correct?
Yes, the mountains of East Tennessee.
Very good. I've spent quite a bit of time down there. I love our listeners down in the Tri-Cities. What can I do for Beth?
We just built a house, and this is our first time owning our own home. And it was a new build, so we had to seed, you know, new grass. And so we have this new grass coming in, and I was just curious as to how to get a lush green grass, but not using, like, harsh chemicals.
Yeah, yeah. So what time of year was your lawn seeded?
It was seeded a little late, I think April.
Okay. That's not late. That's 6 months off of when it should have been seeded. So, I mean, it's either late or early.
Early, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things builders don't tell you is that they will put a lawn in for you in the spring, but it's probably not going to survive. Unless you have zoysia grass or something like that. Now, I know your climate down in the Tri-Cities, even though, quote, you're in Tennessee, people will normally think you're warmer than the Northeast. But your climate is almost exactly like that of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. You're in a weird little climactic pocket there. So I would think that you have a cool season grass, either fescues or bluegrass or something like that.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. Because I presume they fed it when they seeded it. And did they improve the soil at all? Did they bring in topsoil? Did they do anything or did they?
No, they laid, like they rolled out this mats of stuff. I really don't know.
Did they?
The company did it.
Oh, wait a minute.
They rolled out this stuff.
Yeah, so they installed sod?
No, it's not sod. Well, it's like a rollout thing with
seed
hay on top.
With seed embedded in it?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that must be truly weird. Do you still see the rollout stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, man. I don't know where people get these whacked out ideas. Okay, so here's the deal. The most important thing about organic lawn care is that the lawn never be cut below 3 inches. Who does the cutting?
Well, my husband just bought one of those, like, mechanical reel mowers, and that's what he wants to use.
Okay.
So that was another question, too. Is that going to be okay?
No, probably not.
Okay.
Has he used it yet?
I think maybe he's tried it out on some spots.
Okay, because you have to make sure most push mowers, most non-powered, quote, reel mowers, R-E-E-L, their cutting height can't be raised high enough, so the lawn will always suffer. I mean, they're a good idea in theory. Now, I will add that some reel mowers can be adjusted up to 3 inches. So you got to make sure it can cut at 3 inches. If not, you have to take it back and get a mulching mower. You always want to leave your clippings on the lawn. If you go through a drought, give it one deep, long soaking a week. Don't water it every day for short periods of time. And then when we get to the fall, if it still looks decent, what you want to do is give it a good organic feeding. You can find bagged organic lawn fertilizers for sale in your area. You could get a load of bulk compost and spread it on the lawn and rake it in. Your lawn would love that. And then in the spring, you give it another natural feeding. However, there's a possibility that this lawn may burn up over the summer.
Okay.
A good possibility. In which case, you would want to, in late August, have a big load of compost or topsoil delivered, level it perfectly, and then sow the seed of your choice into it and just keep it watered. No mulch, none of these rollout mats, none of this stupid idea. Just keep it well watered. That grass would then survive. If it is fescue, you have to contact the builder and find out what kind you got. What brand name it was, because fescues will need to be overseeded every couple of falls no matter what. You need to spread seed around because they don't, they're clumping grasses. So any damage that's done, it can't repair. See, you need to be able to match that grass if this lawn survives.
Okay.
And then there's two resources I want you to go to. Go to our show. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. And at the top of the page, it says Garden Answers A to Z.
Okay.
Go to L for lawn care. If your lawn survives over this summer, and July and August will tell the tale, then all you have to do is read spring and fall lawn care, and that'll hold your hand and tell you exactly how to fertilize and cut. But if it browns out, if it burns up, you want to contact the builder and get him to install a new lawn correctly in late August, early September. And that's where you want to read the article that says new lawn. And that'll tell you exactly how to do it. None of this nonsense with these straw mats and hay. It's all just garbage.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's very helpful.
But if you cut it 3 inches and you feed it in the spring and the fall, once a lawn is established, it'll really do well.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Bethany, and good luck in your new home.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. 1-888-346-9499. Elaine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Elaine. Where are you?
We're in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania, East Norton area.
Oh, okay. Jeffersonville, that threw me, but I know where East Norton is.
Right. It's more the rural area of Jeffersonville.
Oh, okay. Very good. Did Jefferson have something to do with your...
I have no idea. I've never done research about
that. You know, you see all those signs in the cartoons and sometimes in real life in Philly, George Washington slept here. But it doesn't appear like Jefferson slept anywhere, right?
Yeah, maybe he did. We'll have to find that out.
Yeah, there you go. Inquiring minds. What can we do for Elaine in Jeffersonville?
Well, we were helping some friends do some yard work,
mm-hmm.
and they had a tree growing in a bed right beside the house. It was very close to the house, and they hadn't done any yard work. They bought the house about 2 years ago, and the gardens were not the top priority.
Sure.
And so by the time we got to them, a tree had grown up. They had taken it down one weekend, and we came over another weekend to help weed. And what had happened was where the tree was cut, a whole slew of mini trees grew out in the garden bed and into the lawn, which looked to be like along the root system of the tree. Now, my question was, I didn't know if it was a sumac tree or a walnut tree.
It almost sounds more like a black locust or something like that.
Ah, the yard has hickory nut trees in it also.
Hickories are well behaved. Are they getting nuts?
Okay. Not yet. No, they're really low. They just came out like in 2 weeks. They're about knee high, and there are dozens of them in the garden bed.
Oh, and I don't think they're hickories.
Okay.
Ever seen the Sorcerer's Apprentice sequence in Fantasia?
You know,
I think that's what your friends got. This is what's called suckering. A lot of trees will do this even without being cut down. They will send up these adventurous shoots that rarely, if ever, produce good trees. But there are any tree that has a propensity to sucker will send these up if the main tree is cut down because it wants to try to preserve itself. Now, the good news is every one of these suckers is using up energy from the root system.
Yay.
So if the suckers are prevented from leafing out, you can imagine the enormous expenditure of energy without any reward from photosynthesis. If the suckers are allowed to leaf out, then they can re-energize. Cutting the suckers just as they're about to leaf out maximizes the stress on the root system, because otherwise it sounds like you'd have to tear up the entire landscape.
That's what we were trying to avoid, and
yep.
I was wondering if we had to do that to get rid of the root system.
I don't even know that it would work to get rid of the root system. When people do things like that, there's always one little piece of Mickey's broom that's left behind, you know, and then cue the music, whereby the rope-a-dope method always works. And that is just, you know, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. One thing my friend Lee Reich taught me is with some of these trees that sucker, it is better to try to snap them off the root system then to prune them. Now, it won't work with every type of plant, but if you can grab a hold of one of these spikes and twist it and snap it off, that one won't regrow.
Okay.
But pruning always stimulates growth. So anytime you prune one off, it's going to stimulate regrowth. But again, just think of a gas tank underground, and every time you cut one of those and it gets replaced, the needle goes a little more towards empty.
Okay.
So that is the best way, and if you can snap them as opposed to cutting them, it'll go much faster and it'll be over much quicker. But no matter what, this system works.
Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Elaine.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Take care. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Garlic. How to harvest a year-long supply. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer. Let's get a garlic discussion growing by you reading this week's question.
Sounds good, Mike. We heard from Michael in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, who writes, I love your show and listen religiously. You've done such a good job teaching me how to grow garlic that I harvest 100 nice-sized heads every year. My problem is that I can never get them to last. The heads get dried out after about 4 months. Is there a way to make the garlic I'll soon harvest last until next summer? And Mike, before you get to the specific question, why don't you quickly review how and when to harvest garlic? This is the time of year it's getting ready, right?
Absolutely, Alexis. I tend to think of the 4th of July as a good time for me not to be away, because that's when my garlic typically comes in. But the exact timing depends on a lot of factors. Your USDA growing zone, raised beds versus flat ground, the amount of sun and rain you've had that season.
So is there a secret harvest clue, or do you need X-ray vision?
Ah, I feel lucky if regular vision is one of my superpowers most days. Here's the progression of garlic growing. You plant individual cloves in the fall, right around the start of the school year. Then the following spring, if you planted the type of garlic that produces a seed head, you cut and use those scapes as soon as they appear.
Oh, I love when you bring in your extras to share. We stir fry them up with our dinner that night.
Or you can make garlic vinegar with them. The important thing is to cut them off promptly so you can harvest the biggest possible heads a few weeks to a month later. But you can't predict that harvest date with a calendar. You got to keep an eye on your garlic and pull up a test bulb when the bottom leaves are brown on most of your plants.
Just the bottom leaves?
Oh, yeah. If you wait until all the above-ground plant growth is turned brown, the wrappers will be split open and the harvest will be ruined. Pick a plant that's still green on top, but whose bottom third is brown, and check that bulb. If it's nice and fat and full with a good solid paper wrapper, start harvesting.
What if it looks like a big leak or the head seems small?
Then you just wash that one off, use it to flavor a meal. All parts of the garlic plant are tasty and edible. Wait a few more days and test another plant. When you decide it's ready, pull up all the plants and air dry them in a cool, breezy spot out of direct sun for at least a week. Then brush the dirt off and carefully examine your harvest.
Don't wash them?
No. That would shorten the storage life immensely. Just gently brush them dry, use any damaged ones right away, and hang the rest in a cool, dry, airy place indoors.
But is Michael correct that they won't last long?
That's right. If you only grow what are called hardneck varieties, the ones that produce the scapes in the spring, they have great flavor, colorful wrappers, and there are lots of different kinds, including all the wonderful heirloom varieties. But hardneck garlics don't store well. The cloves begin to sprout or go bad about 4 months after harvest. Softneck varieties, often called white garlic or California garlic, is less diverse, less colorful, and for my money, much less flavorful. But softneck garlic will keep for up to a year. So if you really want to be using your own homegrown garlic in March, you should grow some softnecks for storage.
But you don't. You preserve your harvest by making lots of garlic powder, right?
Yep. I sort out and save the biggest cloves for replanting. Then I slice up the rest, dry them in a big food dehydrator, and put the completely dry chunks into sealed jars with those little desiccating pouches. Then I grind the chunks into fresh garlic powder as I need it, like with coffee beans.
At least until the holidays.
Right. That's when I make up big batches of garlic powder to give away as gifts.
Great gifts. It's so much more flavorful than what you can get in the store. I love it.
Yeah, that was subtle. As was the fact that you just gave me the empty jar from last Christmas.
I just wanted to make sure you have enough jars. Anyway, Michael also wrote that he knew about your garlic powder recipe, which we'll put a link to with this question of the week, but wanted to know what you thought about some other preservation ideas he found online.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I'll tell you what. I'll comment on a few of those ideas when we post this question of the week. But I'll tell you right now, I'm convinced that garlic powder is the way to go. It really preserves the flavor, and it's really easy to use.
And it makes a great gift.
Down, girl. Well, that sure was some good information about harvesting and using garlic now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully, with this week a little extra discussion about other preservation tactics, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to grind up all my garlic if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore. At garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Where you can also listen to the show, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Love Train Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Happily reeking of garlic are our editor Al Banks. Our interns, Jolie Higassi and Cecily Garber. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And me, Clove Master Mike McGrath. And even though this is radio, you well might smell me before you see me next week. Some people encourage birds to eat their bad bugs. Others cut to the chase and enjoy insect hors d'oeuvres directly. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll eat some bugs. Plus, how to get rid of aphids without harming bees and your fabulous phone calls.